Henry Reinge here with Dr. Roy Clauser, and we're talking about the doyward aspects of reality, and as he's explained it in the new critique of theoretic thought. Now, you know, I remember from Durr College. Now, I had gone to Durr College. They generously promoted Dr. Hermann Doyward's Christian philosophy. I remember all that. And then I remember, and so we're doing the aspects. We've done some in the last presentation. Now we're on to some more. But I remember, Dr. Clauser, this, and maybe you can help make sense out of it a little bit, this like passive function, subject, or even the terminology.
Subject and object.
A subject and object. And I remember at the time, I mean, I'm in my early 20s, and I'm like, what is he talking about? And I don't think I got that clear back then.
Because in English we use subject and object usually in another sense. We use subject to mean the subject is doing whatever we're talking about. That is seeing, hearing,
right.
Speaking, thinking, and,
right.
and we use object for whatever they're speaking, thinking about. And
okay.
He uses subject to mean that which is subject to these laws.
Oh.
Yeah.
Subject
and,
to these laws.
Yeah.
Is that like the active?
Well, I've used the terms active and passive.
Because you brought that in the last presentation. So this is connecting.
Okay. I think it makes
so
a lot
active
clearer.
Is yeah. Actively subject to the laws in the aspect.
That's right. And passive means that it is subject to the laws, but in a way that we know only when we relate to and come in contact with it. Let me give an example.
Okay,
the Earth is the third planet from the Sun.
Okay, third.
It has that characteristic whether we know it or not.
Right.
The Earth also has the characteristic of being countable by
right.
us.
Like
it didn't, we couldn't know it's the third planet from the Sun.
Okay.
It would be anyway, but we wouldn't know it. So the passive property of being countable is just as real for our purposes, right?
Right?
Not for the Earth. The Earth could exist without it.
Right.
But all things are made in this theory. All things
right.
made all things so that they function under the laws of all the aspects at once.
So and there's a passive aspect to any one thing.
Yeah, but they are subject to the laws of all the aspects in two ways, actively and passively.
Okay.
So the planet Earth really has that property independently of us, but it's only the third, only known to be in relation to us. We can do the same thing with every other aspect. Some things are passively spatial, that is,
right.
they're movable.
Right.
They're passively physical because we can weigh them,
right.
for example.
Biotic, a human could be weighed.
Yeah. Things, and this is an important one. Things, all things have logical properties. That sounds weird. People say, no, it's just propositions and arguments that have logical properties.
Mm-hmm.
No, objects around us are logically distinguishable from one another.
Right.
They don't think logically, but they're able to be distinguished logically. If not, I couldn't tell the walls from the floor from the door. I'd be in pretty bad shape trying to get out of here.
Right.
So things have properties actively or passively.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not exclusive. They have some actively, and they have all the rest passively. They're simultaneous.
Right, so they can have more than one aspect functioning.
In every aspect.
In the science of reality.
Right. A real object,
okay.
like the door over there, really has quantity. It
yeah.
occupies a specific space.
Space.
And can move in it.
Okay.
It has physical properties of being solid.
Mm-hmm.
It has weight, mass, specific gravity, and other physical properties. Then when you say, well, does it have sensory properties? The door doesn't perceive or feel,
right.
but it can be perceived.
Be perceived.
It doesn't think
the
logically.
The passive language voice. It
yeah,
can be perceived.
That's right. So it doesn't think, but it can be thought of. It can be distinguished.
Right.
We can form a concept of it.
Right.
And this is the way you go through the rest. So the rest of the aspects, so that all things have some properties in every aspect.
Right.
They function in some ways actively and passively, and the rest only passively.
Okay.
And now the point of all that is to try to get at the natures of the things we encounter in the world around us.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're trying to get at the nature of the door, we're going to say that that's more complicated because it's an artifact, but its
right.
natural materials are qualified right. physically or biotically. It's biotic if it's wood, it's physical if it's the doorknob, and we can begin to get a bead on parsing and taking apart the natures of the things that we are presented with.
Let's see if I get this, and please correct me if I'm wrong. I'm very okay with that. Okay, let's take the sun. Okay, in a lot of ways, the energy, the nuclear fusions and all the other stuff that's happening, we can actively see. But on the other hand, it's really important that it is being warm to us.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, so it's like in some ways when you look at the sun, it doesn't exist in itself to specifically give us heat. Now, God made it that way, so it would. But from a scientific perspective, its passive quality is very handy for us.
Oh, yeah. It's very important. That's right.
God made it so its passive quality, gives photosynthesis to the plants. And example where, so a lot of times people will say, well, I just want the active quality. I'm just going to skip over the passive quality. But the passive qualities are very important.
Well, without them, we don't know about the object. See, we know the sun because it's perceived by us.
Right.
So it doesn't do any perceiving. I don't think the sun is a person who knows us.
No.
But the sun is a physically qualified object. We understand some of the atomic characteristics of fusion that produce the heat and the light.
Yeah.
But it's perceivable by us.
Right.
And it allows us to perceive other things.
Well, and think of it, the numeric, it's ideal that it's 93 plus million miles away,
yes.
and it's not like 40 million miles away.
And we wouldn't be here talking about it.
Well, it's passive, it's just fascinating how, but now, back to practical life, being clear about the active and passive natures of reality helps in ministry. It helps, some of you are exploring enterprise, bivocational ministry, and when you have a product that you're trying to feature or help, you want to know this active aspects and its passive aspects. Now, I don't know if you should use philosophy this way, Doctor, and you can correct me if
I'm wrong. Properties that are active or passive.
I understand.
And aspect is a kind of properties and laws.
Right.
Which is a very basic kind. That is, it can't be subsumed under any other without running into some incoherencies.
Right.
And it can't be eliminated without running into incoherencies. But it's also the case that they are not reducible to one another in Dewey-Rudd's ontology.
Right.
That is unique. I don't know of any ontology prior to him that escaped all reduction. That is, estimating certain aspects as more real in a sense than others.
Mm-hmm.
The others depend on this. This doesn't depend on them.
Right.
That kind of thing. And he sees them as equally real, especially with respect to their laws.
Right.
So for him, from the time of the Big Bang, from the instant of creation of the world by God, there had been laws for the things that exist now.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several different kinds of laws. One we've talked about, the laws that hold among the properties of the same kind.
Right.
Yeah.
So I like all that. What I'm given is there's a study that philosophy majors economically do very well. You mentioned in our chatting about a Michigan study that was a 52% of the
51 or 52% of the people who graduated from the business school with MBAs and then went on to make it to vice president or above, that was the way they framed
it,
and had been philosophy majors. They were stunned.
Right, and other research shows they do it. I know that I have enjoyed my philosophy major. Dr. Fettes is a philosophy major. Now, I bring this up because I'm going to show you something that I do that philosophy helped me. So let's say I'm trying to promote online ministry training, and that's what I do, and so forth. But when I think about anything we do, I think about this Dr. Clauser in along with the aspects intuitively. Because, so when we talk about benefits and everything, I'm looking for the passive benefits, the active benefits, and all the other things. Okay. Now, why it doesn't surprise me that as you are in this class and you are studying philosophy, the implications and the use for philosophy starts getting you thinking. Like you start actually, like, oh, there's this aspect and that aspect, and in life, all of our life are all these aspects, and there's passive, like back to the concept of the sun. I mean, the sun, what are the benefits of the sun? Okay? And if you think along this area, you can start like looking at these aspects in our pre-theoretic, as you put it, or our experience. We can start seeing how God made this in a beautiful array, even if we don't study each one scientifically.
Yes, that's true. That's very true. It can have that effect, and it can be very beneficial in a number of ways.
So let's now get back to our list, the sensory. So I'm launching back in with Dr. Clauser in the aspects. So you wrote in The Myth of Religious Neutrality, the term sensory is used in the way explained in Chapter 9, that is to cover the qualities and laws of both perception, touch, taste, sight, smell, sound, and the feeling elicited by perception. That seems a little deep to me.
Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, what are you talking about here?
We perceive objects around us as having not only sensory properties. I want to say that first.
Okay.
Our perceptions, there's a very popular theory ever since modern philosophy arose that what we are really perceiving are just properties in our own minds, and a thing is an arrangement of properties.
Okay.
And they're only sensory, so they have to be colors, tastes, sounds, touches, and so on. And what I'm getting at here is what's conveyed to us in normal sense perception is a great deal more than that.
Okay.
So we not only see the color white, if I'm looking at an object that's painted white, but we also, in that perception, see its spatial shape. We get an idea of its quantity as compared to other things.
Okay.
We also, what's conveyed in that experience to us is that it's logically distinct from other things, and if I know the kind of thing it is, I may have a definition of it.
I see.
Maybe.
Right.
But it has passive logical properties that would allow that. It has a social function. And we go through all the other aspects
we'll
here.
Yeah, we'll get to some of them.
Yeah, it's economically worth so much money. It belongs to somebody else in the legal sense.
Mm-hmm.
I may think it's aesthetically hideous.
Right.
And I might think that I would trust it for this or that purpose. Those are all those are properties that it has passively in all the other aspects. So once you get this aspect theory of this list, and you see how Dewey argues that they're not reducible to one another, that the program, the agenda of trying to reduce them all to some one or two is a God substitute program.
Right.
It's because they don't believe there's a transcendent creator. There has to be a purely physical kind of thing that generates everything else.
Right.
Or it's the purely physical plus the purely logical, and
they
interact. Or it's the physical and the mathematical. Or and we get this long parade throughout the history of philosophy. It's this, no, it's this, no, it's this thing.
Or a partnership of two aspects, as you're bringing up.
Yeah, like, or that's right. Or and then here's the first ontology that escapes that completely and says, no, things have properties of all the kinds because the laws of all those kinds of laws govern everything in creation, and objects and as well as people and other things have these characteristics actively or actively and passively or passive.
Okay, so you know, I'm listening as kind of a philosopher, sort of like amateur. Okay, so just a couple of things. Is it possible? This is a little sidetrack here. Is it possible that Dory Weird's thought of the laws that govern, that laws could be reduced? Like someone could understand Dory Weird wrongly and see that he's basically creating a new reduction. It's the law reduction.
No, he makes it very clear that the law is his name for the orderliness that we observe among the properties.
Oh, right? So it's not like it's law, not, like somebody would typically think of law.
Okay, I'll try to do this. This is a little well, drawing fine points here.
Okay.
What we observe isn't a law. It's things behaving according to a law, and often we can deduce at least part of that law.
Right.
But the law is not a Platonic object. It's not something else and another dimension of reality, thing. It is the orderliness of things that God has built into it. Okay. So we're refusing to Platonize the laws and have them be a distinct reality.
Like the perfect law.
Like the perfections. Nor is it merely the natures of the objects acting in accordance with their nature, and we generalize it into a law. Law is a third kind of something that is its own sort of reality.
I get you.
It is the order of the creation, and one side of that law order is the laws of that hold for properties of the same kind. Okay. Another side are causal laws. Causal laws don't have just one aspect. If I take a brick and heave it at a window, then we could talk about the momentum of the brick, the hardness, as opposed to the surface tensile strength of the glass. You can explain it physically, but it has way more properties than physical. I've destroyed a window. Somebody else's property.
Well, and from a sensory perspective, or on that one, if I throw a brick at you and hit you in the face, you feel...
That's right. It's biologically dangerous.
Right.
It's socially disruptive.
Yeah.
I've destroyed somebody else's property. There's a juridical side to that. I could get arrested for doing this.
Right.
So the action has all the characteristics or potential characteristics. And if it doesn't have them actively, as the physical, it does have the physical ones actively, passively, it has the others. It's still able to be judged an illegal act. It's able to be judged somebody else's property, and so on. And we all realize that those causal laws are not absolute in the way that the spectral laws are, because sooner or later you can throw a brick at a window and it bounces off. It doesn't break the glass.
Okay, so I remember in my philosophy studies, so if I feel heat, is that sensory or is that thinking? Let's say I feel joy.
Well, that is going to have potential in every aspect as well. You're perceiving the heat is qualified sensorily. It's a perception.
Right.
But you have at the same time logically distinguish it from other perceptions.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And the heat may be a signal that the building's on fire. You can take that as a symbolic. Okay. And the whatever causes the heat, it could be, as I said, it could be the building's on fire. It could just be that somebody's baking a nice pie, and you feel the heat, and then you smell the pie, and it's okay. The heat's good.
Right.
So it has many different kinds of characteristics at once. We don't explore them all equally, but we can be aware of them.
So now the sensory, is that reduced? Can people reduce the sensory?
People have actually not reduced the sensory, but yes, materialists reduce the sensory to the physical.
Oh, I see. So it's a marriage. It's a partnership between material and sensory.
No, well, their goal is to explain things that seem to be perceptual characteristics as really only physical. So they're reducing this. They're getting rid of the sensory aspect. On the other hand, there's a philosophical tradition that claims everything that we know is sensory and it's nothing else. There are no physical objects. There are no objects with physical characteristics.
Like, what one is that?
This is a rough approximation of the way George Berkeley argued for this. It's kind of nuts.
I'm actually surprised that here this philosopher, 8 years old, can pull these names out. And I'm waiting to get him where he goes, like, oh, I don't know that name. So I don't know if I'm going to get that today, but we'll see.
It's the products of a misspent youth.
I see. Okay, very good. So you're on this. You know, Berkeley did what?
Well, Berkeley comes to somebody and says, you believe that there are objects that are physical and they're the real thing. Okay, now tell me what you mean by physical. And so somebody says, well, it's solid.
Right.
Right? One thing can't pass through it without changing it.
Right.
And he says, well, wait a minute, solid, isn't that the feeling of resistance when you touch it? Well, that's a feeling. Come on now, tell me something that's not a feeling.
Right.
Well, or a perception, see. And so you say, well, if I have another object that's solid, it won't pass through this one without partially destroying it, altering
right.
it. Oh, but those are sights, right?
Right.
Those are visual perceptions of the way things... And he gradually puts somebody in a position of having to conclude that they never really talked about anything non-sensory at all. It
right.
was all sense perceptions. Barclay calls them a congeries of sense.
Right.
It's all these sensations put together, and that's what that's what the world is.
Right.
See, and we experience the world as it is, except
right.
that we go beyond that. We say, no, well, there must be a physical reality behind the sensations. Barclay says, how would you know that?
Right.
If all you know are sensations, how are you going to arrive at something else?
Right.
And here's the kicker. He did this as a Christian.
Okay.
Because he wanted to say that the fact that these perceptions persist in existing even when nobody's around to see them. And we know that because we light the candle, everybody leaves the room, everybody comes back, the candle's burned out.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was there.
Right.
That proves that there is one mind that perceives everything all the time.
Hmm.
And that's God.
Interesting. So, but it's still a reduction. Now,
it's reducing all the other kinds of properties and laws to the sensory.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought he could get an argument for God out of that. There's a wonderful little limerick that summarizes his position. And the students who have trouble remembering the other parts of his position all like the limerick. They never forget the limerick. There was a young man who said, God must find it exceedingly odd when he sees that this tree continues to be when there's no one about in the quad. See, it's because if a thing is a perception, somebody's got to be perceiving it.
Right.
Okay. All right. And the second part is a letter from God to the young man.
Okay.
Okay. So I was going to give that second one.
So there's a second one. And
dear sir, your astonishment's odd. I am always about in the quad. And that's why the tree will continue to be, since observed by yours faithfully, God.
Amazing.
Now, that's an easy, if you can remember the limerick, it's an easy way to remember what Barclay was trying to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
David Hume takes that same position and tries to wrap it around his neck. He tries to say, if all we know are sensations, then
right.
we don't know that there's God. God's not a sensation. We don't know that human beings have a self
yeah.
or a soul. We don't know. And Hume goes through and just demolishes everything everybody thought they knew, whether
right.
Christian or not. And so,
Hume the guy who did what's hot, what's cold, what's, you know, I'm trying to, somehow I remember.
I don't remember that.
See, this is so many years ago. Okay, one more thing about this. So now when it comes to how in ministry, a lot of times when somebody will come to a pastoral care visit, you'll see I just really feel, abused, or I feel, now, on one level, as a pastor, a minister, or a bivocational leader, we're letting them speak, and then we're finding out where they're hurt in pain. So God makes the sensory to be highly valuable to live.
Oh, that's right. You can't survive without that.
Right. Yeah, sure. So many counselors and pastors and chaplains are getting people to talk, to reveal how that sensory perceived hurt and
right.
what to do about it, or who to forgive, how not to become bitter.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, can it be reduced? You know, I remember one man who said, I finally came to realize that I have to forgive so the sensory does not kill me.
I see. Yeah.
So isn't that fascinating? It's like, with the point when I asked the Lord, in fact, for this particular person, that was one of the most powerful examples of the self-evident presence of God, to be able to
right.
have the power to forgive so the sensory
did not
dominate his life.
This aspect includes emotive.
Yeah,
emotions.
Yes,
that's how the term came about. In the old English, it was what we receive, what our emotions,
right?
And that then we perceive the motion of light, the motion of this thing. And then our reaction is the E-motion.
Right, E-motion.
That's right, coined the term.
Look at that, the kinetic with the sensory. I mean, you know, it's like you see how God has these laws, and then you see how these realities and the different aspects combine together. Okay, the next one's the logical. Distinction, conceptualization.
Right. And here we have the human capacity actively to think logically.
Okay.
Whereas other things have logical properties passively. They are able to be distinguished. They are able to be conceived. They may even be able to be defined. And this is an aspect it is very difficult to try to get rid of. Because any theory that tries to say, well, everything's really only physical. No, it's really only sensory. It is missing the logical aspect. Ah. At the same time, the thinker is using it to argue for his position. That's not exactly a coherent, consistent position.
Right.
That it's not itself a logical fallacy, but it could very well be what we call self-referentially incoherent. That is, it's the kind of proposal which when you make it, it blows itself up.
I gotcha.
You know, that the expression in Shakespeare is someone is hoist on his own petard. A petard was a landmine.
Okay.
So the guy who goes out to put the landmine for somebody else ends up blown up into the air by it himself. That's what I think happens to theories that try to disregard the logical, reduce it to the physical or something else.
Mm-hmm.
They're all caught on that dilemma. They're all caught with that mess.
Now, so let's talk about the logical. I mean, logic, thinking, Descartes. I think, therefore, I am.
Yeah.
Now it's interesting. The I am statements in the Bible, you know, are like, you know, God gives his name, I am that I am.
Yeah.
And the logical, can that be reduced?
Descartes was trying to find a truth that was so certain for everybody that it couldn't be denied. He wanted that as a fixed basis to build an epistemology.
Okay.
So a theory of knowledge. That
right.
This is how we know other things.
Right.
But there's got to be one thing that just couldn't be wrong. So what he says, here's my candidate. Whenever I, speaking in the first place, and first person, say, I do not exist, that's incoherent in the sense that I had to exist to make the statement.
Right.
And that's not a logical truth. Some people have misunderstood him to be claiming this is a logical tautology and it's something that can only come out true in a truth table. And Bertrand Russell says it doesn't do it, so his argument fails.
Right.
No, that's very short-sighted. What he's actually doing there is noticing another sort of incoherence, and it's one I call self-performatively incoherent.
Okay.
And that means that the claim you're making is incompatible with the actions it took to make it. So we're aware of
that. Now, is that not deep? Now, did you not?
No, no, it's actually simple.
It's simple.
Yeah, sure. Suppose I have a beaker with water in it, and I want to know the temperature of the water.
Right.
So I stick a thermometer in. I say, there you are, it's 78 degrees.
Okay.
No, it changed when I put the thermometer in. The thermometer can't help but change the temperature of the water. That's not the temperature the water was. It's, we now know what it is, but not what it was before. Putting the thermometer in is an operation, a performance,
right,
an act that it takes to know something. It destroys what it is we want to know. And that's what I'm saying is going on there. But Descartes never distinguished it. He didn't call it that.
No.
He just, but what he's...
Because he's adding himself as a thermometer.
That's right.
Into the...
So that he's saying, as
problem.
Soon as I say I don't exist, that has to be false because I had to exist to say it.
Right.
I think that much is right, but it applies to a lot of other things, too.
Right.
We can find that incoherence all over the place.
Right. In fact, it's probably not really observed, that coherence, because that's the problem.
In fact, what I argue at the end of the book that I'm finishing up now is that any attempt to take anyone whose nature is any one of the aspects, take any natural thing in the cosmos whose nature is qualified mathematically, spatially, physically, sensorily, and so on,
right,
and say that is the divine reality, the self-existent reality,
right,
that generates everything else, runs into exactly that incoherence. It ends
right.
up that the person claims, makes a claim on behalf of a candidate for divinity
right.
that he could not know to be true given the process,
right,
the activities he has to engage in order to try to argue for it.
Right. It's almost as if and he has to recuse himself, you know, from that one aspect.
That's right.
The actual being the observer puts him at a compromised position.
Yeah.
Or being the, you know, active agent in there. Okay, so who reduces the logical then?
Well,
not really Descartes.
No,
who reduces the logical?
No. There are very few people who do that other than materialists. David Hume came close.
Okay.
Remember, he was in favor of everything sensory.
Yeah.
And he dismissed logic. He disses it when he says,
right.
He says this, whenever we incline toward one conclusion rather than another, 'tis only because it strikes more strongly on our fancy.
Gotcha.
It's not for reasons, it doesn't follow from an argument.
Mm-hmm.
Now that seems to dismiss things. So on the other
right.
hand, he uses logical distinctions all the time, and he's logically very sharp in criticizing other people.
Right.
So you've got to say, well, which is it? We don't
right.
we don't go by logic at all, or we do. You know,
right.
I mean, you're claiming one and doing the other.
Right.
So there are people who have tried to dismiss it. More often people have tried to say that's self-existent.
Right.
Maybe that plus matter or that plus sensations or something else, but that's one of the things that just couldn't fail to exist and couldn't be any different from what it is. And so more often it's been deified than denied.
I see.
And it's been deified by Christians who
yeah.
want to say that's the correct way to think of logic. It is self-existent, but that's okay because that's part of God.
Well, and I feel like I've seen it in Christian circles where logical propositions connect, and these logical laws are connected to another. So if this is right, then that's right, and then that's
yep.
right. And then that construct of the Enlightenment is, you know, thrown onto our personal lives, or it's thrown onto theology, or thrown onto the Bible, and then what you get is this more about how the laws of logic must be right, or is God must be tamed by these laws? Is, you know, C.S. Lewis said that you know, in a sense, God's not a tame lion, but it seems like there's some people
okay.
believe logic.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned that there's an old Christian tradition that says that logic is absolute, but that's okay because it's part of God's being.
Right.
And then, so the logical laws are not created by God.
Hmm.
I have to tell you that when I read Colossians 1, it makes it sound as though that's false.
I see.
Colossians 1 says God has created everything visible or invisible.
Right.
So that should include all the laws of creation as well.
Right.
Now, the comeback from the Christians who want to say, no, it's part of God, it's uncreated, but that's okay if it's part of God,
yeah.
is to say that this is it's all right to invest it in God, but it's a law we find in the world, right? We find
right.
creatures exhibiting conformity to this.
Right.
Then I'm saying, according to Colossians 1, we should regard it as created by God.
Right.
The comeback of these other guys goes like this. Oh, then if God created those laws, he can break them.
Right.
So is it true that God can be all-knowing and totally stupid? Is it the case that God can be all good and be the most wicked being?
Right.
Or maybe he can exist without existing, and they get those.
Right. So really, this one and some of the reductions of Thomas Aquinas picking up on Aristotle comes into play.
That's the tradition in which this occurs. And I want to say that there's a reply to that criticism.
Okay.
If God created the laws of logic, and those laws really hold for creatures, that's how we need to think, and it's how we need to analyze the world as it presents itself
right.
and make theories and so on. It does not follow that if God created them, he can break them. Because
mm-hmm.
if God created them, they don't apply to God at all. And nothing can break a law that the law doesn't apply to.
I see.
So you and I can't violate the laws of non-contradiction
mm-hmm.
in reality. We can in our thought. We can
right.
construct a theory that's inconsistent. We don't notice it. And somebody else says, oh, look what you did.
Right.
Okay, but we can't actually be and not be
right.
in the same sense at the same time. We are subject to that law, so we can't
right.
violate it. A law doesn't even apply to God, which is why
right.
we can't violate it.
Right, right.
So we're not saying God can violate those laws and all sorts of silly things result.
Right. Well, one more thing I'm just going to talk about real quickly, and that's this. Last night we were at a social gathering where we were doing some witnessing, and this discussion came up about miracles. And it was totally not logical for one of the people sitting there that how can there be miracles is not logical. You know, logic defines this, and why would God break or allow someone to break his own laws?
He said it about God. He said it doesn't seem reasonable to me that God would set a framework of laws over creation and then step in and break one.
Yes.
And
what do you say about that?
I said I didn't think God breaks laws in causing miracles. You see, every law, physical law that holds for the cosmos as we know it, holds within a closed system. Given these conditions and this and that, then if there's nothing else interferes with it, this will be the result.
Okay.
But every miracle is by definition done by God, and therefore the circumstances do not form a closed system.
Okay.
It's open. The power of God intervenes and you get a different result than you would have otherwise gotten. Think of it this way. If I hold the pen marker up, it's not breaking the law of gravitation because it's not an unsupported object. The law says that in the gravitational field of the Earth, unsupported, heavier-than-air objects are going to fall to the ground.
Right.
But this isn't violating the law because it's not an unsupported object. If I take my hand away and God holds it there, it's still not an unsupported object. It doesn't violate any law. You just have a different source of power supporting the pen. I think most of the miracles, if not all, most certainly fall under this kind of description. Jesus turns water into wine. Well, yeast and grape juice do that just fine all the time.
Right.
Jesus did it faster. Well, okay, the power of God intervenes to speed it up. How does that break the laws?
Right.
Seems to me it requires the laws remain the same. That's why the water it turns into wine, and it's unusual, so it gets your attention. Now, I think that the objection to miracles doesn't come down to very much. Nobody believes in God because they believe in miracles. They believe in miracles because they already believe God is real and can do them.
Right.
So I like what Calvin said about this. He says in one place, if Scripture contained no miracle stories, people would say, wait a minute, you claim this comes from God? If it really came from God, he'd have done miracles to attest that his prophets spoke by his authority. But there are miracle stories in the Bible, so people say, how can we believe that? There's miracle stories in it. Well, I think that he's hit on something there. That's what I find people doing.
Well, this is good. We're going to end part two here because we launch next into the historical, which is extremely interesting, and I can't wait to talk more about it. But I think we've had enough for today, and as we launch into just thinking about the aspects, the practicality. I mean, in ministry, as we think about this last one, I mean, think of how people have done that. How, like, you know, and I see, like, in People Smart, where, you know, some people think they're more logical than somebody else, and they become the answer man in every conversation. They're the ones with the clearest logic, and people like that are out of balance. So even in naive experience, all of this philosophic thinking in the scientific theoretic area has a lot of implications for you in ministry. So until next time, we'll see you then.